News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin, Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profit from UW-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the 1st of February, which makes it the first day of Black History Month. But I think all year long, not just during Black History Month, we need to be mindful of the extraordinary work of an extraordinary woman, Ida B. Wells. And today I am so profoundly honored to be speaking with the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, Michelle Duster, who herself has been a tireless champion for racial justice, gender justice, and has written extensively on very, very important topics. Perhaps you have seen some of her previous books, including Michelle Obama's Impact on African-American Women and Girls. And she has edited two books that include the writings of her esteemed great-grandmother. She has just given the world a new book called Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. And it is a very important contribution to our new and growing understanding of just how significant Ida B. Wells was during her life. The book is published by Atria. Michelle Duster, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Gregory.
I really appreciate the honesty with which you share something early in the book that I was not really prepared to read. And that is, in a sense, how you confess earlier in your life to not having nearly the interest in your great-grandmother and her work as you might otherwise have had, or that you certainly grew to have later on. But I think you say something about being like so many young teenagers, mostly occupied with your own life and your own direct interests and issues. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And then at what point in your life you became newly aware and deeply moved by the legacy of your great-grandmother?
Right. Well, one of the things I wanted to help people understand in Ida B. the Queen is obviously my great-grandmother is a trailblazing journalist, an anti-lynching crusader, a suffragist, a civil rights icon, and she worked in social work. She had a lot of different professions during her lifetime. And I grew up hearing about her. I did not meet her. She died 32 years before I was born. So I learned about her through my grandmother, who was her youngest daughter. And I think, I really do believe that most children and most teenagers are not impressed or not super interested in hearing these sort of old stories of, you know, until you're a little older. And for me, I think what happened was when I was around the age that Ida was, when she achieved some of her groundbreaking work and her trailblazing accomplishments, that I realized how young she was when she, for instance, sue the Chesapeake, Ohio, and Southwestern Railroad. She was only 21 years old. So when I was 21, I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive that she did that, you know, at the same age that I'm not ready to take on a railroad. So that made me more curious.
And, of course, it's one of those stories where the closer one looks, the more impressive she becomes. What is it like for you to examine the life of this woman to whom you are so closely connected, even though, as you just said, you were never able to meet her? But the fact that she is not only this iconic figure in American history whose stature seems to grow by the year, but also someone who is part of you. I mean, I should think that that personal connection is a very special ingredient in all of this.
Right. Well, you know, obviously being related to somebody who's a historic icon is a very unique experience. And so part of that experience is sharing my family with the public. And so that's just different. And my great-grandmother was always an incredible role model to me, and I'm hoping a lot of people. As a black woman who refused to be quiet, she always held her head high, and she challenged systems in order to make the world a better place for everybody. So hopefully that's inspiring to people.
That brings to mind an important aspect of this book that I want to make sure that is mentioned clearly, and that is the fact that your book not only celebrates your great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, but also celebrates the work of people in our own day or close to our own day who in various ways have carried on her work, men and women both. I mean, this is not just a biography of someone who lived a long time ago, but you take great care to connect her work, her activism, to the world in which we are living now and the challenges which we now are confronting.
Exactly. And one of my goals with Ida B. the Queen was to connect the historical dots, to show how Ida's actions a century ago echo through the movements that are happening today in the streets today, in the ongoing fight for black lives and equality, for women, for women's equality, for racial equity. So we have a lot of things going on today that are a continuation of what my great-grandmother Ida B. Wells was fighting during her time.
We're speaking with Michelle Duster about her new book, Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells, who was a tireless champion for justice for so much of her life. She was born in 1862, the daughter of slaves. She died in 1931. Michelle Duster, one of the things I learned about your mother, your great-grandmother that I do not remember knowing before, is the family that she grew up in, the large family, and the terrible tragedy that enveloped that family and really changed her life in a radical way. I am talking about the when illness ended up in sort of a savage stroke, striking down both of her parents and necessitating kind of a radical shift in her professional course. Tell our listeners what befell Ida B. Wells' parents and some of her siblings and the way in which you think that might have been a very important element in who she ultimately became.
Right. Well, one of the things that I included in the book Ida B. the Queen was how my great-grandmother's life was shaped by the loss of her parents. My great-grandmother Ida B. Wells was the oldest of eight children, and both of her parents died when she was 16 years old, along with a younger sibling, and unfortunately another one had passed away earlier. So that left her with five remaining siblings, and she decided, and rather than have her family broken apart and parceled to friends of the family, that she would take on the responsibility of becoming a teacher so that she could take care of her younger siblings. So she worked in a rural school, rural Mississippi, for a little while to help take care of her siblings.
You write at one point, her childhood was officially over. And it's really one of the most stirring things that we read in the entire book about your great-grandmother's amazing life. And we have sort of a sense that this is part of what galvanizes her to live such a remarkable life. Explain to our listeners how Ida B. Wells began to embark on what was a very uncommon career path at that point in time for a black woman, namely as a writer and journalist.
Right. Well, my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, moved to Memphis, where she was teaching for a few years, and she was writing for church newsletters as what today would be considered a side gig. And her journalism career grew as she became more bold and more people learned about her. And that segued into civil rights activism and anti-lynching crusader after three of her friends were killed, and she wrote about it, and she started investigating other lynchings. So her career, her journalism career, was definitely impacted by the lynching of her friends.
Describe to our listeners what kind of a writer she was. I know that one of the things that, of course, gives your new book, Ida B. the Queen, such vivid life is that so much of your great-grandmother's writing is included here, and I'm sure you have tirelessly explored a whole lot of it, far more than could be included within the pages of a single book. Describe the kind of writing that she did and the kind of writer that she was.
Right. As you mentioned, Greg, I mean, I have read through a lot of my great-grandmother's writing, probably almost all of it. And her writing style is very direct, very descriptive. She uses, one of the techniques that she uses that I found very interesting was that she used other people's writing. She incorporated other people's writing to sort of show how what she was saying countered the false narrative at the time. And I can equate it to how some people might today pull up somebody's tweet from a year ago and incorporate it into their article and say, "This, I'm not saying that this person said this. I'm showing you that they said it and from their own source." And I just found that to be brilliant, a technique of hers.
One of the themes to which she returned time and time again was the savage, brutal evil of lynching in the South. And that was one of the narratives that needed to be rewritten in a sense. I mean, a false narrative was being circulated from whites engaging in such a practice. First of all, explain what that false narrative was and the lengths to which your great-grandmother went to properly or correctly rewrite that false narrative about lynching and why lynching occurred.
Right. Well, one of the things that hope people get from the book Ida B. the Queen is the reality that in our country, there has been false narratives told about black people, about the black community, that were used to justify brutality against the community. And what was happening during my great-grandmother Ida B. Wells' time was the narrative that black men were violating white women. And the justification that these people needed to be killed because of this violation. And, you know, we can see some parallels today, and that's what I'm also hoping that people get from the book Ida B. the Queen, is how some of the struggles and the challenges and the issues that my great-grandmother was dealing with are still sort of manifested in a different, slightly different way today, but they're remnants of what she was dealing with.
We're speaking with Michelle Duster and talking about her new book, Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. One of the things that you mention is that from time to time, your great-grandmother was at odds with others who were working for the same causes or trying to address some of the same concerns and issues. And you tell us at one point, Ida's determination and insistence on positive action over reconciliation was not always welcome within the civil rights organizations of her time. Tell us more about that some of that conflict which sometimes did exist between Ida B. Wells and others who favored sometimes a different approach than that which she espoused. Just how big a conflict are we talking about, and how did that actually play out?
Well, during my great-grandmother Ida B. Wells' time, there were what were called sort of different camps. There were the what they called the accommodationists and the sort of radicals and militants. And my great-grandmother Ida B. Wells was definitely considered radical and militant. And the people in that sort of frame of mind were action-oriented, and they were sort of in-your-face confronting the powers that be sort of directly. And they were asking for large, big strokes of action. Something that might be considered similar today might be AOC, how she's considered to be so bold and extreme in her ideas about things, and how other people are saying, well, no, you want to temper your expectations, and let's go slowly, and let's think about this. So that was kind of what my great-grandmother was dealing with during her time. She wanted action right away and, you know, get this done. We don't need to think about it anymore. And her ideas were considered bold and sometimes unrealistic. Yeah, so that's the difference.
I think another example that is worth talking about is that early in the 20th century, this is now decades into her career as a tireless advocate, your great-grandmother was one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, which of course was and remains a significant organization. But your great-grandmother, you tell us, grew quickly frustrated with the organization. Tell us what she found so frustrating about sort of the shape of the NAACP and why she eventually all but abandoned the organization. What was her frustration about this group that she helped to co-create?
Well, one of the things that I hope people take from the book, Ida B. the Queen, is just how bold my great-grandmother was. She was very uncompromising. She believed she had very strong ideas of what is right and wrong, and she really was, in her time, considered to be a difficult person because she just had such strong ideas. And that was part of what happened with the NAACP. She had such strong ideas about action, and she found at the time, the idea of sort of studying the problem to be frustrating.
I think it's really interesting how your great-grandmother really, in a sense, comes alive in the pages of this book, and how some of the most personal insights we gain about her are from the excerpts from her journal. How many years did she keep a journal, and what does one discover about your great-grandmother when one explores that journal?
Right. Well, in the book, Ida B. the Queen, I really made a conscious choice to include a couple of excerpts of my great-grandmother Ida B. Wells' journal because it shows a personal side to her. She kept the journal from 1885 to 1887. So unfortunately, just a couple of years. But it still gave me an insight into her as a young woman. She was in her early to mid-20s. And so, you know, it shows her, her dating, some of the ideas. So she in some of pages of her journal, she would give almost like book reviews. She went to a lot of plays. She was very much into cultural events. She liked fashion. And she was always trying to figure out how to pay for things. She struggled a lot financially. during that time. And so that made me realize that a life was not easy for her.
Hmm. And I think it's really interesting how you share in your book examples of your great-grandmother feeling close to complete despair at certain moments in her career when she suffered setbacks. One of the most painful came in the late 1880s. She had taken legal action against a railroad company because of certain indignities that she had suffered on a train ride, and had initially been successful in that effort, but then the ruling was ultimately reversed, and it was determined that she was had pursued this suit just to harass the railroad company. And in the journal entry that she writes just a few days later, which you share in your book, there are these words: "The Supreme Court reversed the decision of the lower court in my behalf last week. Went to see Judge Greer this afternoon, and he tells me four of them cast their personal prejudices in the scale of justice and decided in the face of all the evidence to the contrary that the smoking car was a first-class coach for colored people as provided for by that statute that calls for separate coaches but first class for the races. I felt so disappointed because I had hoped such great things from my suit for my people generally. I have firmly believed all along that the law was on our side and would, when we appealed to it, give us justice. I feel shorn of that belief and utterly discouraged." It must be really, I mean, it's painful for me to read those words. I can't imagine how painful it is for you to read those words and, in a sense, to have your great-grandmother's pain sort of reawakened with her words. But you tell us that this was a turning point in your great-grandmother's life. Tell us in what way that is true.
Well, Gregory, well, one of the things, one of my ideas about how it was a turning point in her life was that it no longer gave her the idea that the law was on her side, that black people could actually get justice through the legal system. And so I think that's part of the reason why she decided to use journalism as a form of activism, because she would try this country in the court of public opinion versus the legal court system, since she had experienced herself that the legal court system wasn't going to give justice.
You write, "This experience was a turning point in Wells's life, for although it disillusioned her, it also sparked a rage against injustice that would always remain with her. And while the decision broke her heart, it toughened her spirit." We're speaking with Michelle Duster about her new book, Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. I appreciate so much that, as I've said, that your book not only chronicles your great-grandmother's incredible life and tireless work on behalf of so many important causes, but also ties this together to the present day. One thing you say at one point is that your mother, your great-grandmother, was somebody who, in a sense, lived in a couple of different worlds. That is, she was someone who met with presidents and with various power brokers, but she was also someone who felt at home, in a sense, in the trenches and with the most ordinary of people, working for their well-being on that kind of level as well. In other words, she was not just someone comfortable with high-sounding ideals, but also someone willing to get in and do some of the hardest work. Can you just speak to that?
Right. Well, that's one of the most fascinating things I found about my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells. And I wanted to help people who read Ida B. the Queen sort of see that part of who she was. I've coined my own phrase of she was a class straddler because, like you said, she met with two different presidents, President McKinley in 1898 about having an anti-lynching crime bill. Does that sound familiar? And then she met with Woodrow Wilson in 1913 because he was resegregating the federal government. And then she went to visit prisoners in Little Rock, Arkansas after there was a race riot. And so she advocated for black people to be considered full citizens and enjoy all that this country had to offer from an individual level and then also from a policy level.
One of the really touching moments towards the very end of the book is when you describe being given the honor of being on a float with some other interesting people in the 2020 Rose Bowl parade. And it was a float specifically celebrating the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which, of course, finally and completely gave all women the right to vote at the federal level. And explain to our listeners who was on this very special float on this very special occasion and what that experience meant for you.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, on New Year's Day 2020, I rode on a float that was dedicated to the centennial of the suffrage movement. And there were other people, other descendants, the descendant of Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Harriet Tubman. The five of us were included on the float. And so that was really an honor to meet other descendants of these people. Most of them knew each other and or worked together. And so for us to connect, you know, several generations later was very special.
How would you explain this enormous swell of interest in your great-grandmother and her work, which we have experienced in very recent years? What is it about her and her life that, in a sense, is such an important story for us to be embracing today?
Well, I mean, my great-grandmother was a trailblazing journalist. She was an anti-lynching crusader, a suffragist, a civil rights icon. She also was a social worker, and she started her career as a teacher. So when you combine all of those things that she did in her life and then what we're dealing with today, when it comes to educational inequality in some areas, there's an attack. There's been a recent attack on journalists. So people are starting to look at what my great grandmother did as a journalist, and how did they, how did she navigate this world? We're dealing with the Black Lives Matter movement right now, and she could arguably be considered a Black Lives Matter advocate for during her time. And then we have this political advancement when it comes to women in politics. So, you know, the idea of women participating not only as voters, but actual candidates and political officers is a direct tie to the work that my great-grandmother was doing.
And as we said earlier, your book is not only a celebration of your great-grandmother, but also of some of the present-day activists who carry on her work. The book, again, is titled Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells, published by One Signal Publishers, a division of Atria, and the author, Michelle Duster. Michelle Duster, thank you so much for giving the world this marvelous book, and thank you for being part of today's morning show. I really appreciate it. It was an honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Gregory. It was great to be with you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. If there is anything that people in modern America, throughout the world for that matter, tend to take entirely for granted, it is the notion of instant photography, of pointing your camera, your iPhone at something, pressing a button, and voila, there is the image forever captured. Once upon a time, and those of us who are old enough vividly remember this, you had a camera with film in it, and when that film was exhausted, you wound it up, you opened up your camera, you tucked it into an envelope, and you mailed it off, and you waited for those pictures to be developed and to be returned in the mail. And that was a whole different world. It feels like a different planet we're describing. And one of the geniuses who helped change the whole notion of photography is a man by the name of Edwin Land. And he helped develop the famous Polaroid camera and a brand new technology which utterly transformed people's understanding of photography and their expectations. But with the development of that spectacular new Polaroid camera came some real trouble in the form of various competitors encroaching on those important discoveries. And hence the stuff of a fascinating new book called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, in which we hear about the struggle for Edwin Land and the Polaroid company to fend off competition from Polaroid, from Kodak, with technology which they believed encroached upon their patents. And the author of this book is someone who was involved in that groundbreaking case, Ron Feirstein. He was a lawyer with the firm of Fish and Neve, representing Polaroid in that battle with Eastman Kodak. And Ron Feirstein, as a matter of fact, worked very closely with two of the most important witnesses on behalf of Polaroid, Dr. Edwin Land himself, as well as Howard Rogers. And so he has a very intimate understanding of this entire dispute and its significance. Since then, he has gone on to a career of representing a number of people in the recording and theater industries, and but has taken time out of that busy, interesting life to write this fascinating book, again called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War. And Ronald Feirstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you today?
Just fine. I am so happy to talk with you. A couple of times in the last year or so, for no particular reason, I have thought about the Polaroid camera. I so vividly remember our well-to-do relatives from Milwaukee coming to visit us in our little town in northeast Iowa, and my Uncle Carl having with him one of these spectacular Polaroid cameras, and at least the one he had, this would have been in the mid-60s, was, you know, now in my mind's eye, a huge contraption. But this notion of the picture, you pull it off, you peel this thing away, and you wait, and just within seconds, you actually see this image. It was like an astonishing miracle.
There's a great quote from Arthur Clarke, the famous science fiction writer, that says, he said back when, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think that's exactly what you're touching on, Greg. This was a radical departure from the way photography had been done for more than 100 years, where you could hold the photograph in your hand just moments after pressing the shutter.
It was just... In some ways, you feel like... You were present when you saw your first automobile or something like that, when all you'd known before that was horse and buggy or stagecoaches or something. Exactly. I don't know, but it felt, in a sense, almost as revolutionary.
Well, you know, an interesting aspect, in your introduction, you talked about, you know, how people can take pictures with digital cameras these days or their phones, for example, and of course that's true, but the big difference between that kind of instant photography, if you will, and the kind that Polaroid did was that with Polaroid you actually held a print in your hand, and with the digital camera, of course, you have to show the photograph on the screen and otherwise, but it's not quite the same thing.
No, not exactly. And I think it's also one of those instances in which now, of course, a Polaroid camera, it might as well be a butter churn in terms of its utter irrelevancy to our modern life. And yet, at some point in time, this was a spectacular innovation. And I think one of the interesting things about your book is that you help us understand the science behind this innovation, beyond the really interesting sort of legal battles which ensued. Talk for a moment, first of all, about Edwin Land himself. I wish we had longer to talk because he is an extraordinarily fascinating figure who apparently from very early in his life was tremendously fascinated with light. Tell us more about that.
Well, he, as a young camper in a summer camp, a counselor demonstrated to the kids the phenomenon of polarization. Polarization, very simply, is the ability of some materials to be able to take the glare out of bright light. The only material that people knew about in those days, which were the 20s, were big pieces of crystal, big pieces of rock that could take the glare out of bright light. And Land, as a young man and some of his friends, they immediately thought of all kinds of applications for a more practical material, so everything from sunglasses to camera filters to taking the glare out of automobile headlights. And so he committed himself to that. It became an obsession of his. He started experiments in high school. He went off to Harvard but dropped out in his first year to pursue experiments to try and come up with a practical polarizer. And then at the age of 19 years old, he solved the problem. He found a way to create a very thin piece of plastic that had microscopic crystals embedded in it. That could take the glare out of bright light. And from that, he was able to start his company, which became Polaroid. And your sunglasses of today, your LED screens, your polarizing filters on your cameras, so many, many applications use that technology that Edwin Land developed at the age of 19, back in the 20s.
Hmm. The prologue of your book talks about a moment in 1943. Describe to our listeners the event that you describe in your prologue.
Well, what happened was Land had built a $200 million company based upon this polarizer technology. A lot of the growth came from World War II, where they produced all kinds of devices for the military. But at the end of the war, as the war was winding down, he became concerned about the future of his company because he was never able to sell the polarizer to Detroit as a great idea. And so he thought, well, this is going to be a limited market for this invention. I need something else to apply my energies to and the energies of my company. And he was on vacation with his daughter. They were taking a walk in New Mexico, enjoying the light, snapping away, taking photographs. And when they were done and they were walking to the drugstore where he had to drop off the film to get it developed, his daughter started tugging on his pants and going, "Daddy, Daddy, I don't want to wait. I want to see the photographs now." And, you know, a lot of fathers would just dismiss a young kid complaining about that, but not Edwin Land. Edwin Land, it really sparked something in his mind, and he immediately set out to come up with a photography system, a revolutionary one, that would provide a photograph within moments after snapping the shutter.
Hmm. Tell us more about what was required to achieve this technological breakthrough, and just how radical a reshaping of the whole process was this? I mean, was he taking technology that already existed and just sort of shaping it and altering its process, or was this completely different from the kind of photography that had been done before?
Well, you know, Land used to say that all scientists and all inventors' work rests on the shoulders of those who went before them. And so I think that that's absolutely true, and it was true in this case. This technology is called diffusion transfer, and I don't want to get too technical for your audience, but basically you have a material in the negative which then transfers to a positive to create a picture based upon how that negative has been exposed. And it's called diffusion transfer in black and white. It's a silver colloid material that transfers in color. It's a dye. In fact, the same three color dyes that form the color pictures in your computer printer, cyan, yellow, and magenta. And Land started, there had been back into the 19th century some work in diffusion transfer, very simple diffusion transfer processes where a negative would transfer an image onto a piece of glass, or very rudimentary things. And Land started with that technology. But to take that technology to the level where you would have a sharp photograph within a minute was quite a lot of work and quite an undertaking. And he and his team were able to accomplish that in 4 years. So 1947, he was able to demonstrate for the first time the first one-step photographic system. It took sepia photographs. And in 1948, Polaroid put out the first commercial system, which also took sepia photographs. And later, they put out black and white film. And in 1963, they were able to introduce color film. But all of those were peel-apart systems. You know, when Land first conceived of this, he thought of a photograph that would just come out of the camera and develop in your hand. But that wasn't quite possible, and it took a lot of steps to get to that. So the early ones, as you mentioned before, had to be timed and then peeled apart, and then you'd have to cover the print with some kind of chemical to stabilize it, and if you wanted it to lay flat, you'd have to mount it on a piece of cardboard. It wasn't until 1972 that Polaroid put out a system where that really reflected Land's original dream, which was to have a photograph come out of the camera and just develop in your hands with no further action taken by the photographer. And that was called the SX-70, and that was truly revolutionary.
Right. That's even a more amazing development. Well, of course, this is the kind of spectacular breakthrough that had a company like Kodak, of course, really spooked. So tell us what Kodak ended up developing, which Polaroid regarded, it would seem quite rightly, as an encroachment on their own patents.
There are really two themes in my book. One is the story of Edwin Land, who's just the most amazing inventor, third on the list of U.S. inventors behind Thomas Edison, that no one's ever heard of, and I just think his story needs to be told. But the other main story in my book is the relationship between Polaroid and Kodak over 60 years and how it went from mentor-protege to arch-enemies. It really is a story of almost operatic dimension. Polaroid would not have succeeded without Kodak's help. Kodak was instrumental at every step of the way in the early days. Kodak was the first customer for Land's polarizing material back in 1934. They bought the equivalent of $100,000 of that thin plastic that they turned into camera filters. When Land decided to start those experiments we talked about in photography, who did he turn to for the materials? His friends at Kodak. They gave him paper and chemicals and all kinds of things to work with, even though they had no idea what he was doing. And later, when he came up with the final product, he realized that his company couldn't manufacture the negative, so he engaged Kodak to manufacture the negatives for Polaroid film. And in fact, Kodak manufactured the negatives for every Polaroid film from the very beginning in the 40s well into the 1960s. And by the mid-1960s, Polaroid was Kodak's second largest corporate customer, second only to the cigarette manufacturers for whom Kodak made those small white plastic tubes they turned into cigarette filters. So these two companies had a long and mutually beneficial relationship and were very close. Everything changed, though, in 1968 when Land showed the prototype of what was to become SX-70 to his friends at Kodak. For the first time, Kodak looked at that and said, wow, this might be the thing that challenges our domination of amateur photography. Because up to that point, when instant photography was peel apart, Kodak really looked at it as a curiosity, as a niche, you know, and they were happy to be a supplier of the negative. But when they saw this picture that emerged from the camera and didn't require any other work and just developed in front of your eyes, they got nervous. And they said to Land at that point, listen, we'll help you with this new film like we did with the others, but only if you let us manufacture some and sell it in our own yellow boxes. Polaroid couldn't accept that. They didn't think they could compete. And so at that point, the two companies went their separate ways. Polaroid went off to learn how to manufacture its own negative. Kodak went off to figure out how to compete with Polaroid in this field. And it wasn't until 1976, 4 years after Polaroid put out SX-70, that Kodak came out with its own system. Up until that point, no one at Polaroid, including Dr. Land, knew what Kodak was going to come out with. You have to realize Kodak was the most formidable photographic research company on the planet, and so they were fully capable of leapfrogging Polaroid's technology and coming up with something radically better. But in fact, when they came out in 1976 with their system, it really was not radically better. And in fact, it incorporated several aspects of Polaroid's technology. And from that came probably the most important patent technology lawsuit of the 20th century.
Hmm. And we only have a couple of minutes to talk about that process. But I wonder, for the average layman, if you could just give a sense of what the nuts and bolts of such disputes tend to be. I mean, when one is working through whether or not, in fact, a company like Kodak has encroached upon the patent of a company like Polaroid, what specifics are examined and in what way to arrive at a determination?
Well, it's pretty simple. You know, a patent covers an invention. And our patent system says that if you invent something and you disclose it to the world by publishing it in a patent, you can have a monopoly in that invention for a limited period of time, which at the time was 17 years. After the 17 years, it becomes available for everybody to use, but you have your limited 17-year monopoly in your invention. So when someone uses your invention without your permission, you sue them for it's called infringing your patent, because they're using your invention. So the first thing you have to prove is that they're indeed using your invention. So you can prove that by just comparing the product they put out with the invention disclosed in your patent, and you make that connection. The other main contention people who are accused of infringement make is that the patent is no good in the first place. Because even though the patent office may give you a patent, it's not fully determinative forever. And someone can challenge that patent and say, no, patent office was wrong. They shouldn't have granted a patent because the invention disclosed isn't really an invention. Because there is a quantitative level that you have to reach in order to be entitled to an invention. It has to be new. It has to be unobvious to others who are skilled in your art, and so on. So Kodak said in some cases, we didn't use your invention, Polaroid, and in other cases they said, well, Polaroid, the patent you're suing us on is invalid because it shouldn't have been issued in the first place, because the invention disclosed really doesn't rise to the level that warrants a patent.
Hmm. I noticed in your biography that you work directly with two of Polaroid's main witnesses, Dr. Edwin Land and Howard Rogers, during what's called the discovery phase of the litigation process. What was that like for you?
Well, that was a tremendous experience. In fact, I worked with them both through the trial. I wrote the outline for Dr. Land's and Howard Rogers' testimony at the trial, and worked with them through the entire process. And it was fascinating because they were both wonderful gentlemen, incredibly intelligent. Dr. Land was a bit imperious, and some people saw him as harsh and difficult. Many of his employees were scared to death of him, but really, if you got to know him and if he respected you, he was warm, and I will forever be grateful for the fact that he let me work with him and tolerated my efforts, if you will, to learn a technology that he knew about. He knew more about than anybody on the planet, and I was frantically trying to learn this technology and frame it for him in the context of the lawsuit issues. And I really appreciated the fact that he somehow found that my help to be worthwhile and let me work with him. And at the end of the trial, he actually autographed one of his patents for me, and I have it framed and proudly hanging on my office wall.
The book, again, is called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, published by Ankerweich, and the author, Ronald Feirstein. Ronald Feirstein, congratulations on a really, really fascinating book. I appreciate the care with which it is written, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Greg, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, best-selling author Meredith Hall talking about her marvelous new novel called Beneficence. On Wednesday, a follow-up conversation with Richard Stein and Raymond Clark, who are with the Law Enforcement Training Academy here at Gateway Technical College. On Thursday, Diane Rehm, well-known to many public radio listeners, the author of a powerful new book called When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. And on Friday, we'll be rebroadcasting a memorable conversation from 2017 about racism,